From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Thing at Nolan. To the south of where the road between Leesville and Hardy in the state of Missouri crosses the East Fork of May Creek stands an abandoned house. Nobody has lived in it since the summer of 1879, and it is fast going to pieces. For some 3 years before the date mentioned above, it was occupied by the family of Charles May, from one of whose ancestors the creek near which it stands took its name. Mr. May's family consisted of a wife, an adult son, and two young girls. The son's name was John. The names of the daughters are unknown to the writer of this sketch. John May was of a morose and surly disposition, not easily moved to anger, but having an uncommon gift of sullen, implacable hate. His father was quite otherwise of a sunny, jovial disposition, but with a quick temper like a sudden flame kindled in a wisp of straw, which consumes it in a flash and is no more. He cherished no resentments, and his anger gone, was quick to make overtures for reconciliation. He had a brother living nearby who was unlike him in respect of all this, and it was a current witticism in the neighborhood that John had inherited his disposition from his uncle. One day a misunderstanding rose between father and son. Harsh words ensued, and the father struck the son full in the face with his fist. John quietly wiped away the blood that followed the blow, fixed his eyes upon the already penitent offender, and said with cold composure, "You will die for that." The words were overheard by two brothers named Jackson, who were approaching the men at the moment, but seeing them engaged in a quarrel, they retired, apparently unobserved. Charles May afterward related the unfortunate occurrence to his wife and explained that he had apologized to the son for the hasty blow, but without avail. The young man not only rejected his overtures, but refused to withdraw his terrible threat. Nevertheless, there was no open rupture of relationships. John continued living with the family, and things went on very much as before. One Sunday morning in June 1879, about 2 weeks after what had been related, May Sr. left the house immediately after breakfast, taking a spade. He said he was going to make an excavation at a certain spring in a wood about a mile away so that the cattle could obtain water. John remained in the house for some hours, variously occupied in shaving himself, writing letters, and reading a newspaper. His manner was very nearly what it usually was. Perhaps he was a trifle more sullen and surly. At 2 o'clock he left the house. At 5 he returned. For some reason not connected with any interest in his movements, and which is not now recalled, the time of his departure and that of his return were noted by his mother and sisters, as was attested at his trial for murder. It was observed that his clothing was wet in spots, as if, so the prosecution afterward pointed out, he had been removing bloodstains from it. His manner was strange, his look wild. He complained of illness and, going to his room, took to his bed. May Sr. did not return. Later that evening, the nearest neighbors were aroused, and during the night and the following day, a search was prosecuted throughout the wood where the spring was. It resulted in little but the discovery of both men's footprints in the clay about the spring. John May, in the meantime, had grown rapidly worse with what the local physician called brain fever, and in his delirium raved of murder, but did not say whom he conceived to have been murdered, nor whom he imagined to have done the deed. But his threat was recalled by the brothers Jackson, and he was arrested on suspicion and a deputy sheriff put in charge of him at his home. Public opinion ran strongly against him, and but for his illness he would probably have been hanged by a mob. As it was, a meeting of the neighbors was held on Tuesday, and a committee appointed to watch the case and take such action at any time as circumstances might seem to warrant. On Wednesday, all was changed. From the town of Nolan, 8 miles away, came a story which put a quite different light on the matter. Nolan consisted of a schoolhouse, a blacksmith shop, a store, and half dozen dwellings. The store was kept by one Henry Odell, a cousin of the elder May. On the afternoon of the Sunday of May's disappearance, Mr. Odell and four of his neighbors, men of credibility, were sitting in the store smoking and talking. It was a warm day and both the front and the back door were open. At about 3 o'clock, Charles May, who was well known to three of them, entered at the front door and passed out at the rear. He was without hat or coat. He did not look at them, nor return their greeting, a circumstance which did not surprise, for he was evidently seriously hurt. Above the left eyebrow was a wound, a deep gash from which the blood flowed, covering the whole left side of the face and neck and saturating his light gray shirt. Oddly enough, the thought uppermost in the minds of all was that he had been fighting and was going to the brook directly at the back of the store to wash himself. Perhaps there was a feeling of delicacy, a backwoods etiquette, which restrained them from following him to offer assistance. The court records from which mainly this narrative is drawn are silent as to anything but the fact. They waited for him to return, but he did not return. Bordering the brook behind the store is a forest extending for 6 miles back to the Medicine Lodge Hills. As soon as it became known in the neighborhood of the missing man's dwelling that he had been seen in Nolan, there was a marked alteration in public sentiment and feeling. The Vigilance Committee went out of existence without the formality of a resolution. Search along the wooded bottomlands of May Creek was stopped, and nearly the entire male population of the region took to beating the bush about Nolan and in the Medicine Lodge Hills, but of the missing man no trace was found. One of the strangest circumstances of the strange case is the formal indictment and trial of a man for murder of one whose body no human being professed to have seen, one not known to be dead. We are all more or less familiar with the vagaries and eccentricities of frontier law, but this instance, it is thought, is unique. However that may be, it is of record that on recovering from his illness, John May was indicted for the murder of his missing father. Counsel for the defense appears not to have demurred, and the case was tried on its merits. The prosecution was spiritless and perfunctory, the defense easily established, with regard to the deceased, an alibi. If during the time in which John May must have killed Charles May, if he killed him at all, Charles May was miles away from where John May must have been, it is plain that the deceased must have come to his death at the hands of someone else. John May was acquitted, immediately left the country, and was never heard of from that day. Shortly afterward, his mother and sisters moved to St. Louis. The farm having passed into the possession of a man who owns the land adjoining and has a dwelling of his own, the May house has ever since been vacant and has the somber reputation of being haunted. One day after the May family had left the country, some boys playing in the woods along May Creek found concealed under a mass of dead leaves, partly exposed by the rooting of hogs, a spade, nearly new and bright except for a spot on one edge, which was crusted and stained with blood. The implement had the initial CM cut into the handle. This discovery renewed in some degrees the public excitement of a few months before. The earth near the spot where the spade was found was carefully examined, and the result was a finding of the dead body of a man. It had been buried under 2 or 3 feet of soil, and the spot covered with a layer of dead leaves and twigs. There was but little decomposition, a fact attributed to some preservative property in the mineral-bearing soil. Above the left eyebrow was a wound, a deep gash from which blood had flowed, covering the whole left side of the face and neck and saturating the light gray shirt. The skull had been cut through by the blow. The body was that of Charles May. But what was it that passed through Mr. Odell's store at Nolan? The other lodgers. In order to take that train, said Colonel Levering, sitting in a Waldorf Astoria hotel, you have to remain nearly all night in Atlanta. That is a fine city, but I advise you not to put up at DeBreathitt House, one of the principal hotels. It is an old wooden building in urgent need of repair. There are breaches in the walls that you could throw a cat through. The bedrooms have no locks in the doors, no furniture but a single chair in each, and a bedstead without bedding, just a mattress. Even these meager accommodations, you cannot be sure that you will have a monopoly. You must take your chance of being stowed in with a lot of others. Sir, it is a most abominable hotel. The night that I passed in it was an uncomfortable night. I got in late and was shown to my room on the ground floor by an apologetic night clerk with a tallow candle, which he considerably left with me. I was worn out by 2 days and a night of hard railway travel, and had not entirely recovered from a gunshot wound in the head, received in an altercation. Rather than look for better quarters, I lay down on the mattress without removing my clothing and fell asleep. Along toward morning, I awoke. The moon had risen and was shining in at the uncurtained window, illuminating the room with a soft bluish light which seemed somehow a bit spooky, though I dare say it had no uncommon quality. All moonlight is that way, if you will observe it. Imagine my surprise and indignation when I saw the floor occupied by at least a dozen other lodgers. I sat up, earnestly damning the management of that unthinkable hotel. I was about to spring from the bed to go and make trouble for the night clerk, him of the apologetic manner and the tallow candle, when something in the situation affected me with a strange indisposition to move. I suppose I was what a story writer might call frozen with terror, for those men were obviously all dead. They lay on their backs, disposed orderly along three sides of the room, their feet to the walls. Against the other wall farthest from the door stood my bed and the chair. All the faces were covered, but under their white cloths, the features of the two bodies that lay in the square patch of moonlight near the window showed in sharp profile as to nose and chin. I thought this a bad dream and tried to cry out, as one does in a nightmare, but could make no sound. At last, with a desperate effort, I threw my feet to the floor and, passing between the two rows of clouded faces and the two bodies that lay nearest the door, I escaped from the infernal place and ran to the office. The night clerk was there, behind the desk, sitting in the dim light of another tallow candle, just sitting and staring. He did not rise. My abrupt entrance produced no effect upon him, though I must have looked a veritable corpse myself. It occurred to me then that I had not before really observed the fellow. He was a little chap, with a colorless face and the whitest, blankest eyes I ever saw. He had no more expression than the back of my hand. His clothing was a dirty gray. "Damn you," I said, "what do you mean?" "Just the same," I was shaking like a leaf in the wind and did not recognize my own voice. The night clerk rose, bowed apologetically, and, well, he was no longer there. And at that moment I felt a hand laid upon my shoulder from behind. Just fancy that if you can. Unspeakably frightened, I turned and saw a portly, kind-faced gentleman who asked, "What is the matter, my friend?" I was not long in telling him, but before I made an end of it, he went pale himself. "See here," he said, "are you telling the truth?" I had now got myself in hand, and terror had given place to indignation. "If you dare to doubt it," I said, "I'll hammer the life out of you." "No," he replied, "don't do that. Just sit down till I tell you. This is not a hotel. It used to be. Afterward, it was a hospital. Now it is unoccupied, awaiting a tenant. The room that you mentioned was the dead room. There was always plenty of dead. The fellow that you call the night clerk used to be that, but later he booked the patients as they were brought in. I don't understand his being here. He has been dead a few weeks." "And who are you?" I blurted out. "Oh, I look after the premises. I happened to be passing just now and, seeing a light in here, came in to investigate. Let us have a look into that room," he added, lifting the sputtering candle from the desk. "I'll see you at the devil first," said I, bolting out of the door into the street. "Sir," that breathed house in Atlanta, "it is a beastly place. Don't you stop there. God forbid, your account of it certainly does not suggest comfort. By the way, Colonel, when did all that occur?
In September 1864, shortly after the siege.
Present at a hanging.
An old man named Daniel Baker, living near Lebanon, Iowa, was suspected by his neighbors of having murdered a peddler who had obtained permission to pass the night at his house. This was in 1853, when peddling was more common in the Western country than it is now and was attended with considerable danger. The peddler with his pack traversed the country by all manner of lonely roads and was compelled to rely upon the country people for hospitality. This brought him into relation with queer characters, some of whom were not altogether scrupulous in their methods of making a living, murder being an acceptable means to that end. It occasionally occurred that a peddler with diminished pack and swollen purse would be traced to the lonely dwelling of some rough character and never could be traced beyond. This was so in the case of Old Man Baker, as he was always called. Such names are given in the Western settlements only to elderly persons who are not esteemed. To the general disrepute of social unworth is affixed the special reproach of age. A peddler came to his house and none went away. That is all that anybody knew. 7 years later, the Reverend Mr. Cummings, a Baptist minister, well known in that part of the country, was driving by Baker's farm one night. It was not very dark. There was a bit of moon somewhere above the light veil of mist that lay along the earth. Mr. Cummings, who was at all times a cheerful person, was whistling a tune, which he would occasionally interrupt to speak a word of friendly encouragement to his horse. As he came to a little bridge across a dry ravine, he saw the figure of a man standing upon it, clearly outlined against the gray background of a misty forest. The man had something strapped on his back and carried a heavy stick, obviously an itinerant peddler. His attitude had a suggestion of abstraction like that of a sleepwalker. Mr. Cummings reined in his horse when he arrived in front of him, gave him a pleasant salutation, and invited him to a seat in the vehicle. "If you are going my way," he added. The man raised his head and looked him full in the face, but neither answered nor made any further movement. The minister, with good-natured persistence, repeated his invitation. At this, the man threw his right hand forward from his side and pointed downward as he stood on the extreme edge of the bridge. Mr. Cummings looked past him, over into the ravine, saw nothing unusual, and withdrew his eyes to address the man again. He had disappeared. The horse, which all this time had been uncommonly restless, gave at the same moment a snort of terror and started to run away. Before he had regained control of the animal, the minister was at the crest of the hill 100 yards along. He looked back and saw the figure again, at the same place and in the same attitude as when he had first observed it. Then, for the first time, he was conscious of a sense of the supernatural and drove home as rapidly as his willing horse would go. On arriving at home, he related his adventure to his family, and early the next morning, accompanied by two neighbors, John White Corwell and Abner Razor, returned to the spot. They found the body of Old Man Baker hanging by the neck from one of the beams of the bridge. Immediately beneath the spot where the apparition had stood, a thick coating of dust, slightly dampened by the mist, covered the floor of the bridge, but the only footprints were those of Mr. Cummings' horse. In taking down the body, the men disturbed the loose, friable earth of the slope below, disclosing human bones already nearly uncovered by the action of water and frost. They were identified as those of the lost peddler. At the double inquest, a coroner's jury found that Daniel Baker died by his own hand while suffering from temporary insanity, and that Samuel Moritz was murdered by some person or persons to the jury unknown.
The Spook House. On the road leading north from Manchester and eastern Kentucky to Boonville, 20 miles away, stood in 1862 a wooden plantation house of a somewhat better quality than most of the dwellings in that region. The house was destroyed by fire in the year following, probably by some stragglers from the retreating column of General George W. Morgan when he was driven from Cumberland Gap to the Ohio River by General Kirby Smith. At the time of its destruction, it had 4 or 5 years been vacant. The fields about it were overgrown with brambles, the fences gone, even
The outhouses and outlying quarters for the servants had fallen partly into ruin by neglect and pillage. For all the poor of the vicinity found in the building and fences an abundant supply of fuel, of which they availed themselves without hesitation, openly and by daylight. By daylight alone. After nightfall, no human being except passing strangers ever went near the place. It was known as the Spook House. That it was tenanted by evil spirits, visible, audible, and active, no one in all that region doubted any more than he doubted what he was told of Sundays by the traveling preacher. Its owner's opinion of the matter was unknown. He and his family had disappeared one night, and no trace of them had ever been found. They left everything, household goods, clothing, provisions, the horses in the stables, the cows in the fields, all of the servants, all as it stood. Nothing was missing, except a man, a woman, three girls, a boy, and a babe. It was not altogether surprising that a plantation where seven human beings could be simultaneously effaced and nobody the wiser should be under some suspicion. One night in June 1859, two citizens of Frankfort, Colonel J.C. McArdle and Judge Myron Vay of the state militia, were driving from Boonville to Manchester. Their business was so important that they decided to push on despite the darkness and the mutterings of an approaching storm, which eventually broke upon them just as they arrived opposite the Spook House. The lightning was so incessant that they easily found their way through the gateway and into a shed, where they hitched and unharnessed their team. They then went to the house, through the rain, and knocked at all the doors, without getting any response. Attributing this to the continuous uproar of the thunder, they pushed at one of the doors, which yielded. They entered without further ceremony and closed the door. That instant they were in darkness and silence. Not a gleam of the lightning's unceasing blaze penetrated the windows or crevices. Not a whisper of the awful tumult without reached them there. It was as if they had suddenly been stricken blind and deaf. And McArdle afterwards said that for a moment he believed himself to have been killed by a stroke of lightning as he crossed the threshold. The rest of this adventure can as well be related in his own words from the Frankfort Advocate of August 6, 1876. When I had somewhat recovered from the dazing effect of the transition from uproar to silence, my first impulse was to reopen the door which I had closed and from the knob of which I was not conscious of having removed my hand. I felt it distinctly, still in the clasp of my fingers. My notion was to ascertain by stepping again into the storm whether I had been deprived of sight and hearing. I turned the doorknob and pulled open the door. It led into another room. This apartment was suffused with a faint, greenish light, the source of which I could not determine, making everything distinctly visible, though nothing was sharply defined. Everything, I say, but in truth, the only objects within the blank stone walls of that room were human corpses. In number, they were perhaps 8 or 10. It may well be understood that I did not truly count them. They were of different ages, or rather sizes, from infancy up and of both sexes. All were prostrate on the floor, excepting one, apparently a young woman, who sat up, her back supported by an angle of the wall. A babe was clasped in the arms of another and older woman. A half-grown lad lay face downward across the legs of a full-bearded man. One or two were nearly naked, and the hand of a young girl held the fragment of a gown which she had torn open at the breast. The bodies were in various stages of decay, all greatly shrunken in face and figure. Some were but little more than skeletons. While I stood stupefied with horror by this ghastly spectacle and still holding open the door, by some unaccountable perversity my attention was diverted from the shocking scene and concerned itself with trifles and details. Perhaps my mind, with an instinct of self-preservation, sought relief in matters which would relax its dangerous tension. Among other things, I observed that the door that I was holding open was of heavy iron plates, riveted. Equidistant from one another, from the top and bottom, three strong bolts protruded from the beveled edge. I turned the knob, and they were retracted flush with the edge. released it, and they shot out. It was a spring lock. On the inside, there was no knob, nor any kind of projection, a smooth surface of iron. While noting these things with an interest and attention, which it now astonishes me to recall, I felt myself thrust aside, and Judge Vey, whom in the intensity and vicissitudes of my feelings I had altogether forgotten, pushed by me into the room. "For God's sake," I cried, "do not go in there. Let us get out of this dreadful place." He gave no heed to my entreaties, but as fearless a gentleman as lived in all the South, walked quickly to the center of the room, knelt beside one of the bodies for a closer examination, and tenderly raised its blackened and shriveled head in his hands. A strong, disagreeable odor came through the doorway, completely overpowering me. My senses reeled. I felt myself falling, and in clutching at the edge of the door for support, pushed it shut with a sharp click. I remember no more. 6 weeks later, I recovered my reason in a hotel at Manchester, whither I had been taken by strangers the next day. For all these weeks, I had suffered from a nervous fever attended with constant delirium. I had been found lying in the road several miles from the house, but how I had escaped from it to get there, I never knew. On recovery, or as soon as my physician permitted me to talk, I inquired the fate of Judge Vey, whom, to quiet me, as I now know, they represented as well and at home. No one believed a word of my story, and who can wonder? And who can imagine my grief when, arriving at my home in Frankfurt, 2 months later I learned that Judge Vey had never been heard or seen since that night. I then regretted bitterly the pride which, since the first few days after the recovery of my reason, had forbidden me to repeat my discredited story, insist upon its truth. With all that afterward occurred, the examination of the house, the failure to find any room corresponding to that which I have described, the attempt to have me adjudged insane, and my triumph over my accusers, the readers of The Advocate are familiar. After all these years, I am still confident that excavations which I have neither the legal right to undertake nor the wealth to make would disclose the secret of the disappearance of my unhappy friend, and possibly of the former occupants and owners of the deserted and now destroyed house. I do not despair of yet bringing about a search, and it is a source of deep grief to me that it has been delayed by the undeserved hostility and wise incredulity of the family and friends of the late Judge Vey. Colonel McCardell died in Frankfurt on the 13th day of December in the year 1879.